Today's episode is presented by Public. Public.com has just launched its new high-yield cash account, offering an industry-leading 5.1% APY. No fees, no subscription, and no minimums or maximums. That means you can grow your cash with 5.1% interest with no strings attached. It's as simple as that. Again, that is 5.1% interest with no fees, 5.1% interest with no subscription, 5.1% interest with no minimums or maximums, and 5.1% interest with up to $5 million of FDIC insurance. Just 5.1% interest straight up, no strings attached. Sign up today at public.com/chitchatmoney. This is a paid endorsement for public.com, 5.1% APY as of December 20th, 2023, and is subject to change. Full disclosures and terms and conditions can be found in the podcast description. High-yield cash accounts are available for U.S. members only.
Welcome to Chit Chat Stocks. On this show, hosts Ryan Henderson and Brett Schaefer analyze businesses and riff on the world of investing. As a quick reminder, Chit Chat Stocks is a CCM Media Group podcast. Anything discussed on Chit Chat Stocks by Ryan, Brett, or any other podcast guest is not formal advice or recommendation. Now please enjoy this episode.
Welcome into Chit Chat Stocks. My name is Brett Schaefer, and I'm joined as always by Ryan Henderson. Today is our Wednesday episode, and I think we have a fun one for everyone. As you may have known, or for anyone that's followed the show since the beginning of the year, we have changed up our format for the Wednesday episodes, and we're mixing it up. Don't worry, we are still doing our traditional stock analysis episodes. I've been researching Elf Beauty. We'll be doing that one. I think it'll come out 2 weeks from today. Ryan is researching Dreamfinders Homes, or... What did you nail down there for us, Ryan?
I have been researching Dreamfinders Homes, but I was also looking at Genius Sports. So a little torn between the two. I think I'll decide probably in the next week. It's one of those two.
All right. Beautiful. But for some of these episodes, we're trying to mix things up. And during earnings season, we think at least once a quarter, maybe even twice a quarter, depending on how important some of these earnings are, we're going to go through stuff that we own, stuff that's on the watch list. For kind of disclosure for everyone, we run fairly concentrated. Personally, we own about 5 to 10 stocks, maybe a little bit more as we build out our portfolios. And we have a watch list of about 20 to 30 companies, I'd say. So we're going to pick some that either is on the watch list or we actually own. And for anyone that saw the title, we're going to do 5 stocks that we'd buy right now. So some of these we own, some of these we don't. 3 of them are going to be from Ryan. 2 of them are going to be from me. We're going to have a 10-minute timer on the presentation and update so we can get done with this in an efficient manner and have some fun discussion questions. For each company, again, we will disclose whether we own shares as of this recording, but any of these companies we may buy in the future. So if we sound biased to the bullish side on the business, we probably are. You should always do your own research and don't buy just because we're talking about this on a podcast. Before we get started, if you enjoy Chit Chat Stocks, give us a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That is the best way to support and help a free show such as ours grow. And then subscribe to our newsletter called Chit Chat Stocks to get all our show notes. And the link to that will be in this podcast show notes, or you can search it on Substack. Lastly, thank you to our sponsors, public.com and finchat.io. Okay, 5 stocks we'd buy today. First one is Ryan discussing good old Coupon. I own shares. I'll let Ryan disclose if he owns shares and what his plan is for that later. But I see that we're running up on 3 minutes here in the recording. So Ryan, you have 10 minutes. Let's get started.
Yeah, and it's going to be, I think the way we're doing this is it's going to try to be a 5-minute elevator pitch and then leave an extra 5 minutes for discussion between the two of us. So I'm going to kick things off. I think my timer is going now. First company I'm talking about, as you mentioned, is Coupon. For those of you that are not familiar with this business at all, Coupon is the leading e-commerce provider in South Korea. They are sometimes referred to as the Amazon of South Korea. Now, I know a lot of companies get that tag that maybe don't deserve it. Jumia, I've heard called the Amazon of Africa before. It can be dangerous to associate or give a company that analogy because then you start to think, oh, it's going to have returns like Amazon. But in this case, I think the model of Coupang, the actual business model, it resembles an early Amazon almost to a T. And frankly, it seems like the founder here, Bomsoo Kim, who owns a ton of the stock and he still runs the company today, he's copied Amazon, basically. Now, in the early days, it was meant to be more of a Groupon-style business, but I'm going to talk about what the business has become today. They are, like I said, an e-commerce platform that's home to 20 million active customers, and those customers, on average, spend $100 a month, roughly, or $1,200 a year on Coupang's platform. What are they spending that money on? Pretty much anything. Coupang's platform sells items ranging from fresh groceries to electronics or apparel, and those items are sometimes first-party merchandise, so stuff that Coupang makes themselves, or items from third-party merchants, which is just, think about it, you know, the local Apple supplier in Korea can build their third-party site on Coupang and tap into a massive buyer base of 20 million active customers where they can sell apples. So pretty simple. That part functions a lot like Amazon. And here's the best part. Coupang has spent the better part of a decade now building out a really robust fulfillment network. Today, they have 47 million square feet of logistics and fulfillment center space. That's equivalent to 816 football fields for our American listeners that are trying to put that into context. And that puts more than 70% of South Korea's population within 7 miles of a Coupang logistics center. So Coupang is able to deliver an incredible 99.3% of its orders within 24 hours. Similar to Amazon Prime, Coupang also has a subscription service, which it calls Rocket Wow. Right now, it costs the equivalent of $4 a month to subscribe to this, but this is free shipping on all items. And it gives members things like Dawn Delivery, which this is the part where I was hearing about Coupang, it sounded kind of cool, and then this kind of unlocked it for me how valuable the service can be. If you order select items on Dawn Delivery, which you get as a member of the Rocket Wow membership, order them before midnight, you can get them delivered to your door before 7 a.m. So that speaks to the population density of South Korea and the fulfillment capabilities of Coupang's business. There's also like free returns and stuff like that where they'll come by and they'll pick up a bag. So you just put it outside your door and they can come and grab it. There are currently around 11 million Rocket Wow subscribers. For context, the entire South Korean population is around 52 million. But beyond its core retail business, Coupang also has some other initiatives. Things like, I would say the most important here is probably Coupang Logistics. This allows the merchants to tap into their delivery network. So I think it's only 4% of units are currently sold using fulfillment by Coupang. But as this grows, it should be margin accretive or boost the profit margin on the core retail business as more and more merchants start paying for services like this. There's also Coupang Eats, Coupang Pay, Coupang Play. These are like video streaming, payments app, all that kind of stuff. These are, I kind of call them side bets, but they also help increase the value of the Rocket Wow membership because you get discounts on Coupang Eats. You get access to Coupang Play, which is that streaming video service. And it just as a whole kind of builds more value around the ecosystem, much like a Prime Video service or Amazon Prime service, I should say. Run through the numbers, though. What am I at on my timer? Do you have a look on it?
4 minutes.
Okay, perfect. I'm on time. So Coupang today has a market cap of $26 billion. They had a huge IPO, actually IPO'd at a really good time, and raised a bunch of cash. So about $5 billion in cash on the balance sheet and less than $1 billion in debt. However, they recently acquired Farfetch, or technically it was like a bridge loan, kind of a complex transaction, but some of that cash is going to leave the balance sheet. So I would estimate around $22 to $23 billion enterprise value. Now, when we look at the earnings of this business, they have turned the corner towards profitability. They were investing really heavily, a lot of the cash they generated from the IPO into expanding that fulfillment network, but they're starting to really see the profits come in. Free cash flow was $1.8 billion over the last 12 months. However, when customers pay Coupang, Coupang holds the cash before they give it back out to the merchants. So they're sitting on a lot of cash that doesn't actually belong to them. Now they can earn interest on that. However, it is not theirs. So you're going to see a big discrepancy between the cash flow and the GAAP numbers. I think probably the best metric here to use is more of a net operating profit after taxes, which I think could be in the ballpark of 5%. Right now, they're generating about 8% to 9% free cash flow margins. Management has said that they think they can get to about 10% adjusted EBITDA margins. Ultimately, I'm kind of baking in a conservative case here that 5% net operating profits after taxes seems achievable. If they grew revenue by 10% a year for the next 5 years, which seems very doable, they have a huge logistics advantage. And I think that more and more people are going to come to them, more and more people are going to spend money on the platform that are already there. That would put them at about just over $30 billion in revenue, almost $2 billion in net operating profits. I think any sort of reasonable multiple that you apply there, you're going to get probably a double in the stock price. And in my opinion, there's a lot more upside to the revenue case there. It seems like they could grow revenue a lot quicker, but just wanted to be conservative there. I guess just in terms of headline numbers, they do trade at 43 times EV to EBIT. So the free cash flow multiple is a little misleading. You still have to believe that this business is going to grow at a pretty healthy clip.
Okay, first question. Do you own shares right now?
Yes. Coupang is my second largest holding. Not sure what percentage of the portfolio that makes up currently, but second largest holding. And I've actually been... It's one of my recent buys. I haven't bought them in quite a while, but I am and would buy at this price.
Okay. And I guess another discussion question would be, what are the key, KPIs that you look at when reading a Coupang earnings release? Is it some sort of margins, active customers? What are maybe the top three you're looking at every quarter is to show whether the business is getting better, moat is widening, all that good stuff?
So active customers, net revenue per active customer, because they actually have a really good, what's the term that they call it? I can't remember. There's like a specific term that they always refer to where it's like how much people spend once they get activated on the service. And it looks really good for them.
Cohort analysis.
Yeah. Great cohort trends where once people get on the service, they start spending a lot of money, they realize the value, and it just tends to go up and to the right. They spend more and more money. So net revenue per active customers. And then I keep an eye on gross margins because I'm okay with them investing throughout the income statement, like the operating expenses. I really want to make sure that gross margin is staying relatively high or maybe expanding, because that's going to drive the rest of the profit margins, whatever you want to pick, whether it's adjusted EBITDA, which I don't think is that useful, but operating income, all that stuff, it's going to be driven by the improvements on the cost of revenue side, which as they're fulfilling more and more orders within their existing routes, it should continue to improve. The gross margins should. So I keep an eye on gross margins, free cash flow, obviously, as well. And then any other tidbits they give us, because frankly, they are a little opaque. They're a little vague sometimes. They don't try to give out all their details around some of the side bets. So I try to take what I can get, but active customers, net revenue per active, and gross margins.
Yes. Most companies would do some sort of conference call with analysts if they bought out a failing online competitor, not even competitor, but online adjacent company like Farfetch, but Coupon has been fairly tight-lipped except for a pretty vague press release. Last question, as we wrap up on our little time schedule here, what are your thoughts on their expansion to Taiwan?
I like it from what I understand so far, and they've actually been very cautious about investing into or expanding into other geographies. It seems like they have a lot of the same kind of population density benefits. And the other part is they are now, it's an automatic win for Taiwanese merchants, right? If you want to ship products, you can now do it to 20 million active customers. So it's an instant like pool of customers for these Taiwanese merchants. They have in the past expanded into operations and then cut it out. I think they launched a store in Japan at one time. They have gone into other markets as well. And they're like, we're testing the waters. If it doesn't work, we're going to cut our investments. They've been testing the waters with Taiwan, and they seem to be saying, we're excited about the opportunity here. We're going to keep investing. So kind of a wait and see approach, but I'd be optimistic if they're seeing positive trends there. All right. I think that's it. Yeah.
That's it for me.
Okay, let's move to your stock of the day, your first stock, Ally Financial. Let me get my timer up here, ready to go. Let's hear the elevator pitch.
Okay, yeah, so as a disclosure, I do not own shares as of this moment, but could see myself buying in the near future. It's definitely one on the top five of my watch list that as I build out the portfolio, I could buy shares. But Ally Financial is a simple business model. It is a consumer bank. So they have two sides that we need to understand before we get into why I think the shares look fairly cheap. They have the attracting of depositors, and then they have making loans. So the assets versus the liabilities. Ally attracts deposits as an online-only bank with higher interest rates than the traditional banks over at Bank of America, JP Morgan Chase, blah, blah, blah. It goes after younger millennial-type customers. For example, it currently offers a 4.35% APY on its online savings account, which is much higher than the national average. And it is able to do so because it is an online-only bank with no physical locations, which saves them on a lot of overhead costs versus someone such as Bank of America. It currently has, for reference, for the size of the business, about 3 million deposit customers and $142 billion in retail deposits. So they're not as large as the big banks, but they're much, much larger than a lot of these neobank, these upstarts, I'm not saying upstart the company, but you know, even someone like SoFi is significantly smaller, even though they're growing quite quickly. And Ally is not a hyper grower, but they've consistently grown their deposits and depositors over the last 15 years since they started operating independently after the great financial crisis when the assets or the entity was spun out of GM Financial. We don't need to go into that today, but then it became an independent bank, Ally Financial. So speaking of GM, on the lending side, Ally focuses on making consumer automotive loans. It has relationships with a lot of dealers, even providing them with loans themselves for, you know, franchises, all the dealerships, floor loans, blah, blah, blah. And that relationships allows them to give them priority on a lot of the automotive loans that come through their door. At the end of last quarter, they had $84.7 billion in automotive loans on the balance sheet. And that is the most important part of the loan book. Ally is, if we're going to the stock here, it's off 36% from all-time highs, which honestly, when I looked at that, not as far down as I would have thought, given the perception around the company. And it is down so much because of the headwinds it is facing both in the automotive lending side and consumer banking side. So on depositors, the higher interest rates from the Fed has made it so Ally had to raise the interest rate it paid to depositors. This increases their costs because, you know, you have to pay your depositors a lot more to keep them around. And then on the automotive lending side, Ally has three things hurting it. Lower interest rate auto loans from the 2020, 2022 vintages, so those kind of three-year periods, they're still sitting on the balance sheet with low interest rates, so they still have to pay their depositors high interest rates. They have reducing car prices and then increasing charge-off rates in their automotive loans. So that's hurting the recovery prices, or excuse me, the recovery value when loans go bad. And, you know, if loans aren't performing as well, well, there's going to be a headwind compared to the last few years. So this is causing their net interest margin. And now we're going into banking terms, but that's basically one of the most important numbers for a bank. It's one of the key, you know, data points I track every quarter looking at this stock, and that is the spread versus what they pay to depositors compared to what they're earning on their loans. That has gone down from 4% compressed to 3.2% in just, you know, 5 or 6 quarters. Very, very stark compression. And this is because Ally is facing, you know, the Federal Reserve going from 0 to 5% quite rapidly. But even with this bad setup, or excuse me, with this, you know, these bad trailing results over the last 18 months, I really think Ally is a good setup from here, because you have their net interest margin headwinds that should abate in 2024. The loan book gets refreshed because of the automotive loans every 2 to 3 years, meaning once we get 2 to 3 years away from the interest rate hiking cycle, it won't have any headwinds from the Federal Reserve hiking rates. We're already 1 year in, essentially. Like, the Fed raised a tiny bit in 2023, but not nearly as much as 2022. So this will allow earnings to grow again as their loan book reprices, but they don't have to grow the interest rate they pay to depositors. So we should see net interest margins expand. Another reason I like the business is they have a proven playbook in attracting more depositors. And this consistency, I think, gives it a huge runway for reinvestment that can lead to an expanding moat as they get more and more economies of scale and really separate themselves from a lot of these online banks. I also think the dealer relationships give them a competitive advantage. They provide insurance to these places. You know, at the end of the day, a car loan is sort of a commodity, but if they get first dibs, I think that helps given their holistic relationship with all these places. And then I like their culture of conservatism and returning capital to shareholders. They have a nice dividend payout and have grown their dividend per share at an impressive rate since going public. Buybacks are also utilized when they have the capital available, which is not today, but should be over the next year or two getting started up again. And they've reduced shares outstanding by 37% in the last 10 years. And frankly, to wrap things up, I think the stock is cheap. When you look at the trailing earnings, we're at a PE of around 12, but I think Ally is severely under-earning at the moment at a market cap of $11 billion. I really think they could be trading at, you know, a 2 to 3 year forward earnings ratio of around 5. Because in, you know, in 2021, for reference, or at least at their peak earnings, they were getting close to about $3 billion in net income. I don't know if they're going to get back to that anytime soon, just because the pandemic period was a little bit of a Goldilocks period. It wasn't going to be replicable, but I think they can get back to $2 billion once these headwinds abate. Other stuff, key risks. I mean, it's a bank. It could blow up, right? The loans could be bad. I'm not an expert at reading financials. I'm not Buffett, although he's in this company. I just have the 3 to 4 KPIs I look at and think if they're underpriced. I have another risk being that the management team has left recently. I think that's the biggest concern for me, because it's unknown why they're leaving. The CEO left to go to a very attractive job in the automotive industry at running a large dealership company. So I don't know what to think about that, but something to keep an eye on for sure. And then there's also the fact that the car lending market could be much worse than we think, where you read all those reports about how it's a ticking time bomb and those videos end up being correct. I don't believe those videos are correct, because Ally has done fine and still earned $1 billion last year while facing a used car price, or excuse me, a used car market where prices were falling, what, like 15%? And they're guiding for them to fall another, I believe, 9% this year. So yeah, I think that sums it up. Ryan, any questions?
Well, I'm about 2 minutes long, but you hit some of the discussion questions anyways. So there were some questions from Twitter about this. We told them we'd be talking about Ally and they sent in some questions. So maybe we'll try to hit on some of those. I think maybe let's just try to contextualize the executive exodus a little more. Is this the biggest concern? Like, if you had to guess why they are leaving, what would it be? And would this ever keep you out?
Okay. I think the CFO leaving, my hunch is that they were fired because they did a bad job in 2022 and 2021 when you kind of looked at when they got fired. And they realized that. that they made some bad decisions that year that has led to the underperformance over the last few quarters. I think the CEO has been around with them for a long time. And he wanted to get through this tough period, but he had this opportunity. I don't know if that was really like he's trying to get out of a terrible situation. What would keep me away is if a new CEO came in, or this new CFO, or some of the other important places at a bank for the executive suite. If they came in and now, say, sometime this year, they end up leaving, that would be a big concern for me. If you get what I mean there.
Yeah, makes sense. Let's do one more question here. Someone asked, are you at all discouraged at the lower buybacks the past 12 to 18 months, given the lower price? Is this a structural disadvantage of banking that when your stock is depressed, you're unable to deploy capital in buying back stock efficiently?
I think you can make that argument, but this last period was maybe an extreme example of what that could be for a bank, where I don't think the volatility of the business cycle for specifically the sector they're in is going to be that extreme going forward. It was more of a generational event with how car prices reacted during the pandemic with all the shortages and all that good stuff. And I think they're going to be able to start buying back in 2024. Yeah, it would have been optimal for them to keep it on the balance sheet. But if you look at some of the charts I'll have for the newsletter, if we look at Q4 2024, they're projected to have only 16% of their loan book at 2021 and prior. And then their FICO scores have gone up at a good amount, I guess, to over at about 707 now. So their credit quality is getting better. They're getting past the potentially poor performing loans by the end of this year. And I think they're going to be able to buy back stock again. Yeah, could the stock be at $40 to $50 instead of the $25 it was at in 2023? Sure. But I don't think you can price in with a bank like that. Sometimes they have to build capital. They're worried about the Basel III stuff that could potentially make them, you know, be more capitalized. So I think they'll get through that. They'll buy back when they can. What I think would be more of a concern is if they just had a culture of bad capital returns, which I think they understand how to drive shareholder value, and that's more important at the end of the day.
All right. That is about 11 minutes. So shall we hop to third company for the day?
Yeah, Ryan's been very prickly about the timing of these for a little behind the scenes look.
We're trying to do like an elevator pitch, you know? We want it to be on the clock.
Before we move on, we want to talk about our friends at FinChat.io. FinChat.io is the complete stock research platform for fundamental investors. Beyond having all the standard financial data for companies around the globe, they also have company-specific segments and KPIs on over 1,500 stocks. So if you want to see Amazon's AWS revenue over the last 10 years, or you want to track Match Group's paying users, maybe you're curious how many stores Sprouts Farmers Market added last quarter, FinChat tracks all those KPIs and literally 500,000 more. We know that if you're a fundamental investor, you probably track this stuff yourself, but this saves so much time and it has all the data you already need. If you aren't sure where to go, you can also simply ask FinChat. That is their conversational AI powered by FinChat's proprietary data. So that'll save you tons and tons of time researching. They've got stock screening tool. They've got fundamental charting that is best in class in terms of design. I use FinChat every day. I absolutely love the platform. Brett does as well. We both use it as our primary dashboard and the place where we do all our research. So if you want to get 25% off any paid plan, use our link, finchat.io/chitchat. That is finchat.io/chitchat. The link will also be in our show notes.
All right. Harbor Diversified is the good.
I don't know if listeners will care whether or not we're on the clock. It would be cool if we could do like a countdown graphic on Riverside here, you know, if that's possible.
Yeah, Riverside, if you're listening, that actually would be a very fun tool. I think a lot of people would utilize a little graphic like that. And they're quite good. So yeah, let's let that happen. But I will start the timer. Harbor Diversified. Very unique company. Maybe I'll give the disclosure before we even get through it, because this one is a microcap. It is thinly traded. So don't go hopping in there thinking like, look, it's one you have to have experience, I think, with how microcaps work. And it is an extremely risky company. And I will say that you probably shouldn't buy it. We're probably done buying it. It hasn't worked yet. But Ryan, as that lead in to discourage people, why do we both own Harbor Diversified?
Yeah, there are some, like, beyond just the risks associated with, like, buying a microcap, there are some actual, like, there's some actual friction. So, you know, you're probably going to have to pay commissions, depending on who your broker is. Like, I buy with Schwab, and they get their commission free on everything else. But with OTC, highly liquid ones, there's going to be commissions. So just kind of think about that as well. You're going to have to buy a lot of shares to kind of make it, to make sure there's not, like, too much trading costs associated with it. But with that said, yeah, Harbor Diversified is a little bit weird. This is not typically the kind of thing I invest in. And I'll start right out and say it's not a great business by any means. So I'm not investing in it because of any sort of lasting competitive advantage or anything like that. This is a $90 million market cap company that I think is attractive purely because of its valuation. And $90 million is a little misleading, so I'll talk about that in a second. But first, let's give some actual context around the business. So Harbor Diversified is the parent company of Air Wisconsin. Air Wisconsin is a regional air carrier that operates routes to 36 cities, all departing from or arriving at Dulles International. So that's, or O'Hare. So it's Washington, D.C. or Chicago. While I don't love the airline business, I do think regional air carriers are at least a little better because they aren't quite as asset intensive. They don't have to pay for the fuel. They don't have to find the flyers. They're kind of a contractor in a way. It's maybe the term to use. They're a partner of the bigger airlines. So here's the way the business model works. Air Wisconsin, they used to have an agreement with United Airlines, but that has since expired, and they signed a new deal with American Airlines to fly exclusively on their behalf until 2028. This means Air Wisconsin is responsible for providing the aircraft and the crew necessary to conduct the flight, while American, in this case, designs the routes, sells the tickets, and pays for the fuel, among other costs. Let's get to the valuation. Maybe I should actually give some history here as well. Harbor Diversified was basically three guys, I think, that either went to Ivy League schools or the Canadian equivalent, and they wanted to make a quick profit. And in 2011, they bought out this failing biotech company for, I can't even remember how much, it was tiny. And the failing biotech was called Harbor Diversified. And they had some net operating losses. So these guys came in, they bought it out, and they stopped. I can't remember what the process is like, but they stopped filing. So you were not able to buy the stock anymore. It wasn't publicly traded. 10 years later, someone came along and figured out that Harbor Diversified had that Shell had bought Air Wisconsin, and that it was a fully functional airline. And so they registered, I think they sued that the Harbor Diversified had to start refiling again. So they came, it went dark as a failing biotech and came public as a functional regional airline. So it had this huge jump up if you look at the stock price, and it'll kind of be confusing, but that's why it happened. But anyways, let's talk numbers. As I mentioned earlier, they've got a quoted market cap of $90 million, but they have some preferred stock that, if we assume it gets converted, their fully diluted market cap comes out to $124 million. Remember that number, $124 million. They had $52 million in debt, but it looks like they just paid all of that down early. So with that paid off, their net cash on hand stands at about just over $100 million. That leaves Harbor Diversified with an enterprise value of $18 million. I know some of these numbers might get confusing, but just remember this. Enterprise value, $18 million. What do you get for the $18 million enterprise value? Well, you get, for starters, Harbor Diversified owns 64 planes. The average age of the fleet is like 20 years old. So they're not going to be worth a ton per plane, but let's assume that each one is worth $300,000. I think they acquired them. They acquired eight a couple of years ago for about like $400,000 a plane. That would be $20 million right off liquidation. But they're not liquidating. They are operating for American. So they have 4 more years in this contract. But if we got, and right now they're flying 45 of the 64 planes, there's plans to up that to 60 planes, but there's kind of a pilot shortage right now. So they're gradually phasing in more planes. I don't know what they would earn, honestly, when they're operating at capacity, but to provide some context, in the last normal year, which was 2019, really, they earned $30 million in earnings before taxes. So that's an $18 million enterprise value that on a normal year earns $30 million in earnings. Instantly, that's kind of what attracted us to it. They could potentially earn almost 2 times their enterprise value in a single year of profits. And they have 4 more years on the contract. So I'll kind of leave it there, but it's stuff could go wrong, no doubt. But I think the upside is massive here if things go well. And I'm not even talking about the arbitration, which is a whole nother deal. I would say this is kind of the lowest risk scenario, is either they have to liquidate or they only kind of tread water profitability wise.
Okay. I think I'm going to have 2 questions then. First, let's talk the United arbitration. What could that mean for the company?
So I mentioned that they had a previous deal with United. At the end of that agreement, it's called the capacity purchase agreement, there were some disputes over how much United owed to Air Wisconsin. That dollar figure that's in dispute is $52 million. So that could be huge for an $18 million enterprise value company. Like if they got all of that, I mean, it's a triple in the EV potentially, or their net cash goes up substantially. But who knows? Like there's no way to know who's going to get that money. They've set cash aside as like an accounts receivable and a notes receivable, I think, is also included in there as well. But it's not baked into the enterprise value. So my assumption with the $18 million EV is that they get none of that. But obviously, if they get some of that, that's huge. Like, I mean, or even all of it potentially, who knows?
Right. I agree with you. It's a big unknown exactly what's going to happen. Last question on Harbor Diversified. What are your thoughts on the share repurchase program? I am seeing loaded up today, they've taken it down by 21% since the beginning of 2021.
They've taken the shares outstanding?
Yeah.
I didn't know it was that high. So I guess the difficulty here is that you'll see sometimes that it's like they bought the shares they repurchased were at a significantly higher value than what they – and I think a lot of that was actually in one transaction, if I'm remembering correctly. They bought back a bunch in one. But they'll buy at the price that's above what – it typically trades at, just because it's, you know, it's hard to get a whole lot of volume doing that. And I think they're maxed out at buying 3 million shares a quarter. They haven't done that. I like it. It tells me that the management team isn't totally trying to screw shareholders, which is a concern because they don't really talk to anyone. People have tried to reach management and they just don't say anything. So you kind of have to guess, like, are they going to, you know, screw shareholders over? It doesn't seem like it since they're buying back at least some of the stock. It's not a huge, like it's nice as kind of a margin of safety, but it's not like the main reason I'd be buying the stock here.
Yeah, I think it's nice. And I think it's a big thing to track because once they start generating cash, I wonder exactly what they're going to do with it. And the numbers could get really attractive if they can buy back a decent amount. And then the stock price even starts going up because then they're buying at a significant discount to the liquidation value. And we're really assuming no residual value with the planes. We're assuming nothing with United. Despite that, even if they generate a meager amount of earnings every quarter, $5 million, things could get quite attractive. All right. We have 2 left. And I will say on Harbor Diversified again, don't mess with microcaps unless you have experience. Go read up on how to invest in microcaps. There's a lot of uniqueness compared to just buying a large cap company. So, yeah. It's probably the worst idea we have here, but it's the highest risk, highest reward, because from our end of this, you know, how we look at it is it's a very opaque microcap, but the chance that it's worth $4, $5, $6 a share is decent.
Yeah. let's just remember, we're emphasizing the risk here, and we're not recommending anyone to buy it at all. We see how risky it is, but
and it hasn't worked so far. It's severely
that's not true. We're up. It's underperformed, but we're up like 10%.
That's true.
From our like original purchase price, which is 3 years ago, so certainly underperformed. But let's talk Nintendo, which is your next stock. Give us the elevator pitch here.
All right. Yep, I'm looking at the timer. All right, this one is always fun. I think people like to talk Nintendo, and the fact that it's up 30%, I think people are going to enjoy talking about it more, although it was more attractive when everyone hated it a couple of years ago or a year ago. So as everyone knows, or probably most of you listening know, it is one of the largest entertainment companies in the world, focusing on games, and specifically both gaming hardware and software. So let's give a quick overview on how the business model works, where their profits come from. So their business model begins with the hardware gaming unit. It has a history of not being really cutting edge, but being pretty innovative on their gameplay techniques. You know, you have the Game Boy, you have the Wii, you have the current one with the Switch. That's their bread and butter. Now, importantly, with their latest hardware, they merged the handheld and console units with the Nintendo Switch, which is a hybrid gaming device you can play as a handheld or hooked up to your TV as a console. It is the most popular pure gaming hardware in the world at the moment, selling over 100 million units and counting 122 million playing users that have grown every year for the last 6 years. So pretty impressive growth in the activity among their customer base. And that's one thing that has attracted us is the durable growth of that since the start of the Switch. But Nintendo doesn't make much in profit selling gaming hardware. It is all in the vertically integrated brands that they have for their own gaming studio and publishing house. So they have, you know, every year they'll publish a few games from their own franchises. This could be Mario, this could be Zelda, this could be Animal Crossing, this could be plenty others, making these games exclusive to the gaming hardware. And I want to go through an example of how important these games can be to their profitability. So for example, this year they launched Zelda Tears of the Kingdom. The game was the most popular one on the Switch so far this year. They have sold over 20 million units since launch less than a year ago. And assuming the global average selling price was just $50, which might even be a conservative because it went for $70 in the US, that is $1 billion in revenue. Rumors are that they hit around break even at, I forgot to put that in there, but it's, I think, 2 to 3 million units. Let's say 3 million units. And the key is, when we go through these numbers, is that they don't have any take rate paid to, you know, Xbox or any other publishing studio because everything is vertically integrated. So the 17 million extra units are pure profit, which could be, in this case, $750 million just from this game to Nintendo so far this year. So why is that important? Is because this fiscal year, ending in March, they are guiding for around $3 billion in earnings. Now, FX rates, foreign exchange rates, can have a big impact here, but, you know, like, how do I say it? It's so important, is these single games, and they're still earning, I guess I should say, over the last year, what they've earned during the peak of the pandemic, not too far off because of how foreign exchange has kind of given them a major headwind. So what do I think the opportunity is here? What do I think about the entertainment expansion? I'm just kind of asking the questions that I know listeners were asking, anyone online was saying, is they were beaten down. Nintendo was due to a concern over declining console sales and whether the next gaming device they release will be a flop like the Wii U. Although I think that sentiment has changed in the last few months. If you read management commentary, they're greatly worried about this happening again. And it looks like the next hardware will be a safer, quote unquote, Switch 2 that'll be a similar form factor. Now, from my viewpoint, I think Ryan's as well, with online accounts, the subscription service, and an already high active player base, I think Nintendo's hardware business can be more like Sony's going forward and a little bit more consistent. Yes, will there always be lumps when launching new devices? Yes. But I have a confidence that they can pump out, say, if they don't get too crazy, and if it's a similar device just with better graphics, I think they can pump out 20 million units for the next 3 to 4 years onto the next Switch releases, which is rumored to be happening this year. Now, it is rumored to be happening this year for the last 2 or 3 years, so we'll see. But, I mean, eventually they're going to release something. And that's coming at a time when people are worried about the console hardware, the console cycle going down, and they're still going to sell 15.5 million units of this first iteration device that is maybe a decade outdated at this point. So they've been quite successful with this. And then the important thing, I guess, is with the gaming hardware, with this new gaming hardware coming into play, they're going to have updated versions of the highly profitable software games, Mario Kart, 3D Mario, Animal Crossing, et cetera, et cetera. And it's important for them to hit these 10 million unit sellers. Now, from a financial perspective, if the new gaming hardware can sell around 20 million units per year, I think they can keep up and grow to around at least $3 billion in annual earnings and likely $4 billion in earnings or more each year going forward. And then this is a complicated business. I will say that unlike Harbor Diversified, there's a little bit more to learn about. But beyond, you know, gaming, Nintendo has actually had a lot of different initiatives that have been quite successful in the last year. So you may have seen the blockbuster Super Mario movie that did over $1 billion at the box office, or have heard of the theme parks they're building with Universal Studios. The important thing with this is that, yes, they can make a decent amount of high margin royalty income here, but the key will be how much they can expand the amount of players who have, as they call it, access to the Nintendo IP. And they have a great graphic in their own slide deck that I'm really just stealing. I'm just listening to what they're saying. They have the gaming console in the middle, and on the outside they have theme parks, visual content, mobile applications, merchandise, and it all feeds back in to the gaming hardware. So they're not necessarily going to make outsized profits from making a movie every 3 years, or from making a mobile app, or from having these stores, but they can drive more engaged fans and grow their fan base for the gaming hardware, which is where they make a lot of their money. So, I don't know. We have a bunch on valuation here. I mean, maybe you just want to ask questions about valuation, because it's a really, really tricky one to value. It's not a straightforward. Sure. Yeah.
I guess, what do you think they could earn in a year? Like, if you looked out 2 to 3 years and everything was successful, the Switch Pro was a huge success, what do you think could potentially be a reasonable earnings figure?
Yeah, so this assumption here is that they release the new Mario Kart game. They maybe have another one of the 3D Marios. Maybe it's another Animal Crossing. And those are quite, you know, successful, and they get the Switch, the new Switch, to have just as much success as the old one. I think, excluding the entertainment expansions, I think they can earn $4 billion to $5 billion a year, but I wouldn't have much confidence it would be that much higher than $4 billion for an average over a multi-year period. Yeah, maybe 1 year it's higher, but look at what they're going to earn this year with Zelda Tears of the Kingdom just blowing things out of the water. I think the key here is expanding the player base with the other entertainment other entertainment form factors, visual content, which when I say that I mean movies and TV, and then the theme parks.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Are you buying shares today?
I am not. I think shares will do well over the next few years, and maybe I can bring it back to why I think they'll do well. So market cap today is actually, given the foreign exchange, it's higher than you'd think. It's at $67 billion. I mean, it used to, it, not too long ago, it was about 40. But they have $16 billion in cash on the balance sheet or equivalent investments, and they have no debt. So that brings the EV down to $50 billion. So if you assume they can hit $4 billion in USD earnings, I think we're sitting at an EV to earnings of about 12.5. I think that's pretty good, but I don't think it's crazy cheap for a company that's, I would say, I don't have an insane amount of confidence that they're going to keep growing or that they'll grow earnings to $5, $6, $7 billion.
I believe to some degree that this time is different when it comes to like the whole console cycle, because everyone wants to reference the Switch or the Wii, and I think it's a little bit different. But what if you are wrong? You know, what if it is the same old console cycle? It doesn't feel quite as cheap as it. It feels like you're baking in that the Switch Pro is going to be a success.
A little bit. I don't think it's baking in everything there at this price. I mean, if they start generating $5 billion to $6 billion in earnings a year and they actually start returning it to shareholders, which they will, I think, do once, I mean, the Japanese government will force them at some point if they get crazy with the percentage of cash on the balance sheet. They've done this with other companies. Yeah, I think returns will be good, but I mean, I like Coupang, I like Match Group, I like the company you're going to talk about next, Philip Morris, a little bit better at these prices. I just, given the what I've seen in the earnings, I'm not that confident that the expansions outside of gaming will bring that much to them financially. Because even with that movie, it's been irrelevant. It's been a nice boost to their non-gaming revenue segment, but like that's still it's still meaningless if you look at the big picture. Maybe I'm underestimating the gaming business, because when the new Mario Kart comes out, that could be huge. But how much bigger can like a new Switch build their entire gaming business? I'm not exactly sure. So I think the company is still undervalued. I think the shares will do well. I would own this in my portfolio. If there was 10 stocks I had to own, I would buy shares. I think it would be one of the 10. But it's a little different than when it was at an EV of like $30 billion a couple of years ago.
Yeah, agreed. All right, let's talk Philip Morris International, my third stock for the day and the last one we're going to talk about. Starting my clock now. It is kind of ironic to say this, but I think Philip Morris, which is one of the oldest publicly traded companies around, their roots date back to the mid-1800s, will be one of the most surprising growth businesses of the next decade. And I believe Philip Morris, which used to be the same as Altria. It used to be one business altogether until I think 2008 was the split. Was the best performing stock from like 1974 to 2007. It was one of the best performing stocks during that time period. I don't think it's going to be one of the best performing again, but I think it can have similar kind of volume growth that it had in its prime with the cigarettes. So, and that's a little ways out, but let's just kind of break down the business for those that don't know. Right now, Philip Morris International is the world's largest tobacco company, I think. I can maybe double check that. Maybe Brett, maybe you could double check that.
Well, I think excluding the Chinese one. But okay. Honestly, it might be British American Tobacco. Either way, it's one of the top three outside of China.
It's larger than British American. I know that for sure. Because I was looking at that recently. But the way I look at it is there are two businesses, cigarettes and not cigarettes. That's not the technical definition that they use, but that's kind of how I think about it. There's the cigarettes business and then everything else. So cigarettes, this consists of – it's really kind of quite a simple business, and I actually like – there's a lot of like qualitative factors that I like about the cigarettes industry as an investor. But the basics are – you have, in this case, Philip Morris has 53 manufacturing facilities located all around the globe. They source a variety of tobacco leaves, typically from suppliers within their local market. And then they sell through a number of different distribution channels, and the gross margins on the business are typically around high 60% range. So it's a low cost to produce. They are highly addictive. There's lots of pricing power, and there's high barriers to entry in terms of competition because you can't really advertise anymore. So a lot of the incumbents are now insulated in this industry. Some of the popular brands that they have are Marlboro. That accounts for 39% of Philip Morris's cigarettes revenue. They also have Parliament, Chesterfield, L&M, Philip Morris, and then there's a number of brands in Indonesia and the Philippines. They operate pretty much everywhere except for the U.S. The U.S. Philip Morris business is called Altria. They sell the Marlboro brand here. They don't operate here. On the cigarette side, we're going to talk about the non-cigarettes business here in a second. But I guess regarding the cigarettes, I think it's okay. I wouldn't buy. I don't know if I'd be buying the stock purely for the cigarettes business because I think it's better than running a cigarettes business in the U.S. because they're not seeing quite as bad of volume declines. However, they haven't been able to do. Yeah, hop in here.
And I think the key thing people underestimate is they're in markets where the overall population is booming compared to, say, the United States, or I guess they're in Europe as well, or China or something like that. Where you're in Africa, you're in Southeast Asia, you're in India, and you're all these places where the population's booming. So if cigarette usage as a percentage of the population is going down, they can actually still grow their volumes just because the population. So those areas are growing so quickly.
Right. So they've seen about like 2% annual volume declines in their cigarettes over the last 3 years, I'd say. In comparison, Altria has seen, I think, like 8% volume declines lately in the last 3 years or so. So it's they've been in kind of economies and geographies that I think are a little better for the traditional tobacco business. Now let's look at their non-cigarettes portfolio. This is primarily IQOS and Zyn. So if you haven't heard of these, if you're in America, I'm surprised you haven't heard of Zyn. But if you haven't heard of IQOS, which, to be honest, I hadn't really been familiar with until I looked at Philip Morris. IQOS has a number of different styles, but it's basically a pen-shaped device that heats tobacco instead of burning it. So the initial machine costs around $80, depending on the market. And then customers buy the IQOS heat sticks, which are basically cigarettes, on a recurring basis. So kind of the razor and blades model. Zyn is the premier nicotine pouch brand in the U.S., which they acquired in the Swedish Match deal, I think about a year and a half ago now. And they tout 70% plus market share in nicotine pouches in the United States. So both of those are considered reduced risk products. I can't remember what the tag specifically is that they get from the FDA, Zyn specifically, but it's considered a healthier alternative to traditional oral tobacco and traditional cigarettes. So they've had pretty strong adoption, but really strong adoption over the last decade. You look at Zyn's volumes and it has been absolutely remarkable. You look at IQOS's volumes, it's been really stellar as well. Reduced risk products revenue now accounts for 40% of Philip Morris's overall business. 4 years ago, it accounted for 20%. So this thing, it's growing quickly. And management has actually said that it's a higher margin business than cigarettes, although there are some costs associated with like a new launch, but it should be margin accretive as they scale. So I know I've got a little bit long on this pitch here. I'll just get to the numbers. Philip Morris generates about $10 billion in net operating profits after taxes. As the reduced risk portfolio grows and cigarettes continue to at least tread water, I think we can expect potentially 10% annual growth in whatever profit metric you want to use, operating income, free cash flow, NOPAT. It's currently traded in EV to operating income is 14.3 times, and they have a dividend yield of 5.8%. So you're getting paid to wait. I think you're getting a sin stock multiple on what will end up being a really strong growth business over the next decade. That's my concluding thought.
Okay. And as we will have throughout the newsletter, I will say you have a nice little chart here of a key performance indicator, reduced risk products revenue over at Philip Morris International from our friends at finchat.io. Again, thank you for them sponsoring the show. I have a question on the potential of reduced risk products going out of their original markets. So Zyn going out of the United States, IQOS going out of Europe, and I think Japan. But say IQOS going into the United States. Thoughts on that? Is there more risk there for success than maybe someone bullish like us is underwriting?
Yeah, I think if IQOS really took off in the U.S., Philip Morris would do exceptionally well. But like as the stock would do well. I'm not sure that it's going to get strong adoption. It's kind of a, like, I just toss my hands up. I don't know. I don't care. It doesn't seem to be priced in. Like, I don't think people, if you're looking at this and you're getting a 6% dividend yield, I don't think people are expecting this to be the next Marlboro within the U.S. Zyn moving outside, I don't know either. I think in both those cases, it's just cherries on top. Like, Velo in Europe is apparently really exceptional, and everyone talks about once it moves to the U.S., it's going to eat Zyn's lunch. But I think Zyn has phenomenal brand notoriety here in the United States, and people don't even – I've asked before, like, have you tried any other nicotine pouch brands? And they're like, what do you mean other nicotine pouch brands? Like, they didn't – they just thought Zyn was its own category. They don't even think about or consider any of the different alternatives. So I think it'll do well in their existing markets, and there's room to run in both. Plus, they have good economic characteristics. Like, they're very profitable and generating cash in both those businesses. I think Zyn's like 50% plus operating margins. It'd be great if they won in additional markets, but I don't think they need to.
Okay. And last question on Philip Morris from me. What do you think of the foreign exchange risk as a U.S. shareholder?
I mean, it's a risk, but it's been hurting them over the last couple years as well. And it could also be a tailwind. Who knows? It hasn't been a tailwind, but I think even if you shave off 2% revenue growth every year, which would be pretty bearish scenario for the world, or maybe just bullish for America, I think you can still do all right. Plus, the dividend helps here. You get paid in it. I guess if you're reinvesting it, you don't. But like, you can take some as you go in dollars if you choose not to reinvest the dividend.
I guess that's another good question. Are you reinvesting the dividend? And wait, do you own?
Yeah, so I am taking the foreign exchange risk.
Are you? Do you own shares today?
Yeah, I own shares in all three that I talked about today.
All right, beautiful. Yeah, and I will say I own shares of Coupang and is that it? Out of these? Oh, and Harbor Diversified. And I will say that Philip Morris
went
down.
Philip Morris.
I don't yet. I was about to say that I think after its earnings drop, it's number one on my watch list at the moment, but it's kind of hard to tell. And I want to ask you, out of these stocks or maybe any others, what you get, you know, your paycheck, you get the extra money that you deposit into your investment account. What is the next stock you think, you know, off the top of your head? If you're going to buy it today, what would that one be? I know it could change next week, but
out of these five
or others,
well, I own an irresponsible amount of Harbor Diversified currently, so
it's probably not that.
Probably not that. I'd maybe go Coupang at these prices. I have bought something this morning. Bought Dreamfinders Homes. But I'm reluctant to recommend that or anything the day after I bought it. But that's more of just a starter position. So I'd say possibly Coupang.
Yeah. And for anyone that's listening, when he means today, it's like a week ago. So don't think, you know, it's the day. Anything can happen in between now and then. But yeah, for me, I think if I didn't have any money in any of these stocks, it would be Coupang. But since it's already a large position for me as well, I will go Philip Morris International because I was surprised at the reaction after the earnings report. Although I'm sure there was some number that, you know, Wall Street, the big timers were like, you got to watch this, man. It's not a, you know, it's not happening, but whatever. I am to it. Say, even, yeah, I was bullish on the reduced risk products, but I'm surprised at how well, even if someone that was bullish on these categories, I'm surprised at how well Philip Morris has done. And it gives them a lot more durability, I think.
Yeah, I wonder how much Zinn's performance as of late, because their volumes were growing at, they were growing really fast prior to the acquisition, but they've accelerated since. So I wonder how much their acquisition like helped having them as distribution partners.
Yeah, and there's, I think that could help. And I think also at the same time, the competitors in nicotine pouches stopped heavily discounting. So I think that helped as well. All right, I think that's a great way to wrap things up. This was five stocks we'd buy right now. I don't know if we'll replicate this exact title going forward, but we're probably going to be doing something like this a couple times a year, maybe once in earnings season, something like that. Ryan, anything else before we close things out and I hit the disclosure?
No, I think that's good. Well, you're talking next week, right? Or is it an interview? What's our Wednesday episode?
We have a interview with Lou Whiteman on Boeing and the state of the aerospace industry. I don't know what the title will be, probably something trying to be catchy. You know, what went wrong with Boeing? Is Boeing fixable? Stuff like that. And the company impacts so many other businesses out there that I think it is an insightful time and important for anyone that follows anything connected to the airline aerospace industry. And then, yes, the week after I will be doing Elf Beauty, which I'm currently researching. All right. Disclosure. We are not financial advisors. Anything we say on this show is not formal advice or recommendation. Ryan, I, or any podcast guest may own securities discussed in this podcast, may have owned them in the past, and may buy, sell, or hold them in the future. Thank you, everyone. We'll see you next time.